In.
Hi, okay. Welcome to Creating Cash Flow for November 19th, 2023.
Cricket.
Hey.
Are you ready to rumble? Okay, let's see here. So Cricket is a cash flow tiger, and she is a film festival consultant for her side gig. And Victory, you're doing another Ask Me Anything webinar about film festival about film festivals, this workshop, and you're doing it on December 2nd, and it's a free or pay what you can thing. Love it. Okay. So your question.
Yes, the question.
All question. So you have a valuable side gig as the panels director for a well-respected regional film festival. You love the people who work for the festival, you love the vibe of the festival, and you love the folks that you meet there. What you don't love is the communication amongst the people in charge. You describe it as friendly chaos. Oh, that's super fun. This will be your third year with them. You negotiated a title change from panels coordinator to director. While the change made it to the website, it didn't stick. It didn't make it onto the org chart or onto your festival badge. And the executive director of the festival constantly calls me coordinator. Yeah, that's not great. And then there's deadlines that are pushed, and you're like, oh no, I thought we were going to do it here. And they're like, no, I was going to do it in August. And you're like, that's my busiest time for my other job. And like all of that kind of stuff. Pre-production is messy. People put off and minimize the need for conversations that need to happen. And sometimes people leave conversations and the one person's like, oh, I thought that was your job. And the other person's like, oh, no, I thought that was your job. Like, not clear. And so you were saying that maybe you should get a contract that states your job title, and you would love help in figuring out how to broach this conversation with the executive director. She's wonderful. I love her so much, but the management and leadership style feels messy. And let's see. You want to figure out how to work with this lovely person. What are your thoughts? You make, in terms of income, in 7 hours of your festival consulting, what they pay you for more than 150 hours of work. But you do it for the love and for the connections. Okay.
So it's valuable in terms of human resources, and I really like this festival, but this August was awful. And I do have a contract, but it just doesn't lay out my responsibilities. And I know they're going to probably send over a new contract by the end of the year. And I was thinking about it this week, and I just thought I did already say something about how the changes were not good in terms of the deadlines, but I really feel like I need to have a conversation about how to clarify what my job is.
Right. And so, with something, and this is kind of for everybody, when you're being paid a little, but you're basically volunteering. You're being paid like
Basically,
a stipend amount of like, here's your gas money. When you're going to volunteer for something, or when you're going to kind of do something for far, far, far less money, you want to ask yourself, what do I want out of this? And how little can I do to get what I need out of it?
Right.
And it's not that you have to you can do as much as you want. It doesn't always have to be like, oh, I want to do the least amount of effort and get the thing I want. That can sound so ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
But this isn't your full, it's not like you have all the time in the world. You have this whole other career you have, you're building your side business. So when you have something that needs to be kind of contained in your life, you want to approach it with like, what do I want and or need out of it?
Mm-hmm.
And then what's the least amount I actually need to do to fulfill what
right.
I want and need out of it? Okay.
Right.
So what do you want your job to be? And where do you want the boundaries? Are you clear on that? Or do you?
I think that's a really good question. Am I clear on what I want out of it? I want to do a really good job because it is my, it is also a very public facing position because I moderate a lot of panels and mm-hmm. I introduce a lot of panels. So my face is there, my voice is there. And so I want everything to go really well. And I think that the way to, that means being really organized about when are we going to finalize the topics and who is on the panels from our list of judges and other attendees. And when am I going to, so once we get that information, I can write panel descriptions. And those are going to be publicized everywhere, from the website to social media, to the program, the PDF of the program. So those need to be very well written. And also there it's marketing. So they need to be enticing. And mm-hmm. I think that the first year I did it, there is a difference between the first year and the second year in that the first year, all the panelists were judges or filmmaker advisory board members. And so those, that slate of people was determined maybe by March, certainly by April or May. So we could go ahead and get our work done. Mm-hmm. And then this past year, we brought in filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And all of that, that's where a lot of chaos happened because the filmmakers were notified, I think, in late July. And then our deadline was about 4 weeks later for the copy. So I think that involving filmmakers was part of the problem. And we have already talked about only involving, not involving filmmakers this year. So I think that would remove part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting, Christine, is that I felt like I had addressed my concerns well, and then this communication, miscommunication happened. And I was like, oh, everything needs to be in writing because I mean, it's always better for things to be in writing, but this miscommunication really made me feel like I need to have the conversation in a polite way to say, I've got so much on my plate this year. I do need to minimize my, how do I say this? I need to minimize my involvement. I need to minimize the number of hours it takes to bring us a high level, mm-hmm. a high quality. What do I say?
Yeah. Let me ask you, hold on, let me write something down. Okay. We won't lose that thread of thought.
Okay.
But is the problem? I'm asking, I don't know. Is the problem that there's scope creep around your position where more gets added to your plate? Or is it just, ugh, things are just inefficiently communicated and decisions aren't made in enough time and deadlines get pushed?
I think it's both.
Okay.
I think
so it's what both. What's the scope creep that you would like to and not have on your plate?
I don't want to be asked to email filmmakers to send in their bios and headshots.
Mm-hmm.
This is the administrative work is part of the scope creep. And that was the main thing around scope creep.
Mm-hmm.
What I also said in our debrief meeting, which was with the whole team, is a very polite version of, I feel like there were a lot of communications that could have happened before the festival that needed to happen that either didn't happen or they happened in, do you use Slack? Do you know what Slack is?
Yeah, I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hate Slack. It is a mess. It is like designed for people to under communicate and for everyone to be confused.
Yes.
That, I really, and I said that, I was like, I'm sorry, I'm older than a lot of people in this room. And I just don't think that it's valuable. I don't think it's helpful. Mm-hmm. And I also think they're misusing it because they didn't make it easy to search things, but that's another thing. But I did already say, mm-hmm. I feel like there are, that I will be asking for more meetings this next year to address mm-hmm. issues rather than trusting Slack or email.
Yeah. And how was, you've identified the problem, but how mm-hmm. is it, how were your comments received?
The executive director, I think, agrees with me on a lot of the issues. I think she struggles as well with some of the issues. And I think that she faces her own unique set of struggles in working with the teams that have mm-hmm. been in place since before she joined the festival. And mm-hmm. so I think that she agrees. I think that from everybody else, it was a Google chat, not Google chat, Google video meeting. And so a bunch of people were in this big room. Actually, the camera wasn't even on because it wasn't working. So I don't know how people, I couldn't see how people were responding. So okay. I don't really know.
Okay. And you guys haven't done anything since to prove like if things are functioning any better or
no.
Not. Okay.
The festival is just at the beginning of October. And so we won't really gear up hard until January, February.
And what you're, it sounds to me, correct me if I'm wrong, what you're basically saying is, look, I love this festival. Mm-hmm. I love being a part of it and donating my time to it to a large degree. I would love to introduce and moderate the panels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and write the descriptions mm-hmm. that then are used in all of our marketing channels.
Yeah.
And I feel that's a very valuable contribution that I'm willing to make. And I no longer want to do this or this or this. And I need more meetings because the deadlines, I cannot accommodate work past the deadline
mm-hmm.
in July. Mm-hmm. Like I can't do that.
Right. Right.
And what's your guess of how that is going to be received? Do you think they're going to go like, oh yeah, yeah, of course. Oh, and you want this title. Do you think they're going to go, oh yeah, 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 not a problem, not a problem. Or they're going to be like, huh.
I think they're going to be fine with it. I think they might be surprised if I ask for it in writing.
Oh, you're going to give it to him in writing.
Okay.
I think you should draw it up. Just rewrite your contract and say, I've prepared, you know, a draft that has everything in writing of what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
You know, feel free to look it over and let me know if there's points that we need to discuss.
And so should I submit that to them before they come to me with the contract, or should I send it in response to the general contract that's going to be sent to me?
I think you can do it either way, because the general contract you're going to get this year is pretty much the same one as you got last year.
True.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, so you could submit it. You could have, I would kind of call a meeting, say the things and say, I've sent you a draft. So you can, we can talk about it. You can incorporate this language into your contract, or we can just sign this contract.
Yeah.
Like present them with your contract.
The contract. My contract.
Yeah, the contract you would like to sign, based, just format it exactly kind of the same way that their contract is done.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can probably just copy from last year's contract.
Yeah.
And then add in my stuff.
Yeah. And if you think, I mean, do you get a raise every year or no? Or like,
I don't think it's going to happen. The funding issues.
Leave that part blank.
Yeah.
Don't put in a money figure, just leave it blank. You know, that's for them to fill in.
Okay.
And the reason I say you should put it all in writing is because they've already proven that they're not really great at the whole organization thing.
Wow.
And you don't want to wait, because they're also proven they're not great at deadlines. So right. Then the contract's like out there, you're waiting for them, and then you have to follow up. When do I get my contract? It's like, no, here. Mm-hmm. You can rewrite it. You can talk. We can talk about it. But here's what I'd like to sign.
Yeah.
I did this for you.
Okay.
Now.
So, I will draft this, call a meeting, say this is what I would like to have in the contract. Mm-hmm. And send it over to them. See if they have any issues. And I think I need to politely say this year is already so busy.
Yeah. Okay. So to the point, what you're really saying to them is, in order for me to continue to contribute, we need this festival season. I need to operate with maximum efficiency, because I have less hours available this year than I had last year.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I can't do this and this or this. I'll need to only, these are my deliverables. This is what I am going to do for you guys. Now, it's all well and good to give a contract and say, this is what I want and blah, blah, blah. But we have to also, before you have this conversation, is identify your leverage. Because you can say all the pretty things you want, then they can sign a contract and then do business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you going to do if it's business as usual? And your badge comes back with the wrong title and all of that good stuff.
You know, I always have whiteout with me. I whited out that title and took a Sharpie and wrote it the correct way.
Right. Uh-huh.
And what is my leverage?
But what are you going to do when they miss their first? What are they going to do? What are you going to do when they miss their first deadline? Because it will be missed. So what are you going to do?
I don't know.
Right. So you have to figure that out. Because what you've taught them, and I'm not saying this is bad, I'm not shaking my finger at you. I'm just painting the picture. So what you've taught them is, no matter what you say and how you'd like to work, if they are scrambling, you will scramble along with them and help everybody cross the finish line.
Yes.
And they are counting on you to play that game. That's the game they're playing. Scramble.
Yeah.
But cricket will help us cross that finish line.
Yeah.
So you are setting yourself up for yet another season where you scramble along with them and help them cross the finish line and then be resentful. So are you willing to let things fall through the cracks, to let things go undone, to miss a deadline and go, well, I don't have any more time to give to this. I had it this month. I do not have it this month. So hopefully you can find other people to do this. Are you willing to have things be a little less excellent because you're not going to rewrite things at the very last minute or polish that stuff for the marketing if they miss the deadline and giving you the information? Like, or are you going to be in control of coordinating everything? You know, either you're running the train, either you're in charge of the train schedule and the train running on time, the whole part of it, or you're not. You're working at an individual train station and like, the train hasn't come yet, but I gotta go. Because
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Because if you're not willing to protect your time in the way that you are saying, I would like my time to be protected in these ways, you're ultimately not willing to do it, then it doesn't even matter if you have a contract.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Teach them that it doesn't matter. You're going to go through this whole thing of like, I want the contract and I want this and I want to work at maximum efficiency. And they'll do business as usual and they'll be like, oh, she didn't mean any of that. She played along. It's fine.
I think that I need to carve out my sort of dead space and say, I will not be available from this date to this date. And what is interesting is that I think that they will see it as, but that's when we get really busy. And I look at it as, these are all things that can be handled earlier.
Correct.
So yeah. I think that I need to figure out what my dead day is. I'm calling it dead day. And say, I really need this to be done. I need my job to be done by this point. And then maybe give, there is a window the first week of October that I could probably be available. But I could give a couple of windows.
Sure. And then you have to hold those boundaries because they will not. So if they email you, you have to return the email and go, I'm unavailable till October 2nd.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And then you have to be willing to let things not be great because you're not doing them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is the harder part.
That's the harder part.
And it sounds to me, it sounds to me like the key for you, like the big thing you get out of it is being on stage and doing the introductions and doing the panels.
Yes. Yes.
Like, what if that's all you did? What if you're like, I will show up in my glorious self, do those introductions, do those panels. You put warm bodies in those seats, I will do it.
Do you mean and not develop the panel descriptions?
not unless you want to.
No, I need to be involved in that. Okay. Like that's part of like how I show up and be
okay.
is my involvement in the planning.
Well, process. I am recommending that you work backwards from,
okay,
this is the least amount of work that I have to do to make me be excellent doing the panels and introduction. Yeah. And then you do just that amount of work and nothing else. Because then you're going to get everything you want out of it without the extra work.
Yeah.
So I want you to really think about what do you want to commit to?
Okay.
Write the contract. Have the meeting. Have them sign. Eventually, everybody needs to, before. Okay. Here's the thing about contracts, guys. If you're like, okay, we're going to do this thing. Great, great, great. I'll prepare the contract. I'll have. And you have not received the contract yet, but yet you get your first email of like, oh, Cricket, can you send us back? You do not do work until that contract is signed. You have zero leverage once you start to do the work, because then they can just wait forever to get, you've just taught them that the contract means nothing because you're willing to do the work.
It's true.
Before you get the contract. Sean, my husband and I are listening to this podcast about these people who were, lots of people who were scanned by this con artist. And it was like person after person after person did all this work for him and never got paid. And I'm like, yeah, week one, when that payment deadline, you stop doing the work. Like, it's amazing to me, but I see it time again.
Yeah.
People do the work with no contract being signed or no payment being, it's like you're teaching them your work for free.
That's true.
And then you get resentful because they haven't paid you. It's like, yeah, but you just taught them that you'll work for free. So why should they pay you? That'll take all the time they need.
Yeah.
Like, why should we do things differently if Cricket will save the day?
Right.
They shouldn't. They've got a smart, capable person who is willing to save the day because your heart wants this festival to be wonderful. But it's not actually your festival.
It's not my festival, and it was very clear to me this year. There are a couple of different organizations that I've worked with this year that I'm just like, we do not have the same values in terms of pre-production. And I am the daughter of a search and rescue pilot for the United States Coast Guard. And I just grew up with this notion of you plan to not have the accident.
You, me, and Kate, we should put on a festival. Now that would be a well-run, organized festival.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
How can we not have the accident, everybody? Let's have that conversation.
Into that with everything tidy and ready to go. And we'd all get a good night's sleep the night before.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
I feel a high level of stress on the floor when I see all these things that have not been done. So I think that might be part of the issue too, is I need to put everything in writing about what I expect on the floor when we get there.
Yes. And then when it's not there, you have to manage your own discomfort.
Yeah.
Instead of leaping in to save the day. You have to be like, not my festival. It's just not, I'm not running the show.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that this is the year, the thing that's going to save me time and energy and stress is to put every single thing in writing so I know I did my job.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And then like, if something's crazy and you're interacting with a panelist and they're like, do you know about this? And you're like, you know, it wouldn't be happening if it was the Cricket Rum Lily Festival, but it's not.
Right.
So this is the best, this is what we got to work with right now. You know, you just state the facts.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about throwing anybody under the bus, but it is about making sure that it's not reflected poorly on you. That's okay to do, because that's what you're getting out of this.
the shine of being public facing and doing a really good job.
Gotcha.
Because if they don't, if there's no consequences of someone missing a deadline, then they'll just miss deadlines. If there's no consequences, if someone doesn't feel the consequences of like, oh yeah, okay, that was on me. I totally missed that up. It's like, yeah. And that person was kind of upset. If you're the buffer, then people don't even realize what's going on.
Right, right.
Yeah. And buffers get burnt out and resentful and waste a lot of energy.
It's true.
I've been a buffer so many times, so I'm speaking from grand experience. And I was like, what am I getting out of this? Nothing.
Doesn't buffer also mean punching bag?
No, there's a spectrum to buffer. Punching bag is here.
Yeah. Punching bags on one end.
Right. But this is really important for everybody. When you're feeling resentment, it is okay to totally make a list of like what the other person is contributing to that. But you also have to look at what you are contributing because you have control over dialing all that stuff back. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But a lot of times smart, capable people are resentful because they are over functioning.
Yes. Yes. Overfunctioning, can see a problem a mile before it shows up. Try to alert everyone else. They don't see the problem. So they don't believe it exists or could exist.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love watching Kate laugh through all this. I know you know what I mean.
So your big, beautiful brain is neutral. It has a light side to it in that you can see the problem a mile away, but the dark side is you expend a lot of energy saving the day for everybody right. else when you're not getting paid to save the day.
I am not getting paid to save the, let me write that down.
Yeah, you should have that tattooed. I know. Yeah. Okay, Cricket.
Okay.
Okay. I'm curious to see how that all... how it all takes place, how it all unfolds.
Nice.
All right. So we are going to do Therese and then Ileana. And then if anybody else has a question, raise your hand. So I'll try to monitor our time. So Therese, are you here? I believe I saw you. Yes. Hi.
Hi.
Okay. Therese is a cash flow tiger. She offers harp music services for luxury events from weddings to corporate parties. And okay. Ah.
Yeah.
Victory. As much as she wanted to give in to someone trying to negotiate her price, she didn't. She held firm. Yep. You held firm. Yep. Congratulations.
I threw my phone away and I was like, I'm not going to do it.
Okay. So we have two interesting things and something else I want to talk to you about. So, first question. You're in the process of raising your prices. This decision was based on feedback from people in the wedding industry, as well as Miata. From your expertise and experience, the price that you're raising is very fair for what you offer. However, as you've started to share these new prices with prospective clients, you've noticed not everyone is jumping to book as they usually would. I've even encountered some prospective clients who attempt to negotiate with me or even contest my price with, well, other harpists are charging this and blah, blah, blah. So how do you set your price and not be tempted to change it even when things don't seem to be working as fast as in the past? It's like, people aren't booking. Is it just an adjustment period? If things are slow, should I lower my prices temporarily? Okay, so this is a nuanced thing. There's no like, no, you should raise your prices. And this is your business. So you can do whatever you need to do with prices, whenever you need to do with prices. There have been times in my life where it's like, oh shit, I need cash. Okay, it's prices are lower.
Everyone gets discount. Yeah.
So I get it. I'm not at all taking a hard line. However, there's also times where it's like, no, I actually need to raise my prices, even if that puts me at a little higher place in the market, not average. And you might need to find new funnels to new clients for whom that price is not a problem. It might be the market that you were just kind of comfortable and in is more comfortable at the lower price. And so the question is, do I want to stay in that market and keep my prices, or do I want to kind of maybe find new avenues for clients at the higher rate? Like,
It's interesting because I've had such a mix of experiences. And for me, Therese, and my body and what I offer, I tend to like the situations that are on the higher spectrum, because usually the people who can afford the higher rates that I've gotten paid for in the past, they seem to be very organized and appreciate the music. They appreciate that quality of quote unquote luxury that the Harp kind of brings. And the space is like a space I want to be in. It feels safe. It feels like easy to get to. It's just a better, it seems like it's a better experience for me. And it's like less, it's less stress for me when it comes to performing. I can just show up, know that like the environment is like great. I like the people and everyone seems to appreciate what I'm offering. And then, you know, sometimes in the lower end of things, there's like some people who really appreciate, usually the person who booked it, and everyone like couldn't care less. And I'm like, that's fine. Like, I got paid. But it's, you know, it's not always an environment that I feel comfortable in, because like sometimes if it's on the lower spectrum, they also have limited funds for a venue. And sometimes that venue is like really janky for me to navigate, if I'm honest. So, but then sometimes people are like really on a budget and they really appreciate it. So, Yeah, I think I, in my heart of hearts, I know what I want, but also I have to be aware that if I have to like have a little discount period or something, maybe I might need to do that.
Okay. So what, what are you thinking? What are you going to raise your prices to?
So my base price right now for ceremonies is $1,500.
Okay.
And that is, so I have six different packages. That's the first package that it starts out. And typically each package just adds on to what this base package is. And it's pre-ceremony music starting at 30 minutes, and then a ceremony and exit song, personal coordination with the wedding team, personal customized repertoire, travel for up to 3 hours, and 1 hour early setup. And then what gets added on are different service. Like I make my own arrangements for couples who are looking for like their special song, but it's not on my list. And also getting there early enough to be a part of the first look photos. Sometimes I offer that, you know, offering a longer extended ceremony music. I do. So it goes up about, I have it at like 500 more for each package. So the highest one that combines everything and additional services is 3,000. Okay. And then other events that are not wedding related start at 1,000. And then the cocktail hour is 1,500 too. So like the base rate is 1,500. And I took a lot of things into consideration with that. You know, there's
a
lot.
Is this your new pricing? Your new pricing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yes. Yeah.
And so what's the average?
The average, like,
in
general,
people hoping to pay?
People are hoping to often pay around.
Yeah, like people are like,
the most I've gotten. Yeah. Or like, is like 1,000 or 1,500, you know, usually 1,500 is not a problem, but you know, people are happy with 1,000. In the past, when I first was starting out, up until recently, I was charging 750. And like everybody was jumping at that. But then when I really realized, I was like, yeah, because when I look at, and that's what I was talking to, I have a lot of people who are in the wedding industry and a lot of DJs, a lot of wedding coordinators and all of that. And they were like, Yeah, because $750 for any like wedding service is a deal. So yeah, of course yeah. people are jumping at that.
Yeah.
And I started to like kind of resent that because I've been playing the harp since I was 9. And I played at a lot of events. It's not an easy instrument to learn. It's very rare. It's hard to move. I wish it was a violin sometimes.
Right.
So, yeah, I've gotten more and more when I book with my event coordinators, I do often get $1,500. And I have been paid $3,000 for jobs and things like that. It's just, yeah, I'm just like, those feel like a few and far between. And the other one seemed easier for me to get. Does that make any sense? I don't know.
Yeah.
Basically going back to what my original question was. Yeah.
So, yeah. What are there one or two or three things you can identify that's might be issues, problems for someone if they go with a harpist who's like super cheap?
Yes. So often the super cheap harpists, they don't have the harp that I have. They don't have a pedal grand harp, which is better for larger engagements because it has a larger soundboard, so the harp can travel. And I also have amplification for it as well that I've set up. So that's one. Two, they don't get my personality.
Right. And what does your personality bring to the...
Well, in addition to being able to communicate effectively with the clients, it also brings a level of personal coordination and organization that I think is really nice for couples who have so much on their plate already. Given my background as a executive and assistant and an assistant, I know how, like, what's the easiest ways to receive email coordination, make sure that you always know that you can contact me, all those things that you don't even think about, I think about. I've had people come to me and say that too. It was just so nice that, like, as soon as we had our call and we went over all the logistics, it was so nice that, like, you were there and, like, we didn't have to worry about it.
Yeah. So if someone came to me, they're like, "Oh, Christine, I'm interested in your harp services." And I'd state my price. Well, my base rate is $1,500. And there's certain things you get with that. And then if there's other things you want with it, my rate goes up to usually around $3,000, but certainly starts at $1,500. Oh, $1,500? Yeah, because we were like thinking more like $1,000. Oh, yeah. No, I can totally understand, you know, if that's what your budget can allow. There's certainly other harpists out there. Let me give you some tips when you're out there, you know, looking at other people. You really want to make sure that they have a harp like I do, a blah, 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 and that they're coming with additional amplification. My harp and setup is designed to make sure that the ambient sound really fills the venue. And the problem with some harpists is their harp is a smaller size of instrument. So you might be paying less for the harp and you might not be able to hear it. So just know that. That's definitely something to look for. And also you want to make sure that, you know, as you start to communicate with them, that communication is really effortless and really professional. I mean, I've had years of working as an assistant, so I'm really good at making sure that my clients feel that way. And if it starts out kind of janky, chances are it's going to continue to be janky. So definitely look out for that when you're thinking of your other harpists. And you also want to, you know, ask if they're a real seasoned performer, because it's not just the fact that they can play the harp. It's the fact that they have the sensitivity to create the ambiance and not interfere with the ambiance that you guys really want. So yeah, when you're looking for somebody else, you know, who fits your budget, definitely think about those three things. Chances are some will be like, oh, okay, well, I don't know, maybe we can, like, what's in the 1500 thing? So do you see how you're selling, you're talking about yourself, but in a way that's sort of like, here's some things, you're educating them about how they should make this decision. And I think the biggest, even if the only part of that that you got out was, okay, but if you're looking for somebody else, just ask them about the size of the instrument and if they have extra amplification, because they might, you, because I think that line about you may pay less for the harpist and not that's like, oh, terrifying. Shit. That would be an oh shit moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, the second to that is this idea of, like, you know, are they a seasoned performer that doesn't, it's not just about them knowing how to play the harp. It's about them knowing how to create the ambiance.
Yeah.
Infuses the space with what you guys want for your very special day.
Can I hire you to play the harp?
No, but you have all that on a recording and you are welcome to take
Yes, I need to go back.
Yes, go back, write it down. When I first started organizing and I realized I was saying things that was like getting, like, it, I just wasn't, I was sabotaging on the phone because I would be like, there'd be a pause and I'd be like, well, I can lower my rates. I was like, I got to stop doing that. And I wrote out a script and I would just like follow and then I'd stop and then I'd wait for them and then I'd continue. But it had, and eventually I kind of got it into my bones, which is why I can say that so fast and off the cuff. And that's, you know, over 22 years of practice. Write it down and own who you are. Because all of every those three points that I just said, your professionalism, the seasoned performer, and the instrument that you have, that's all true. That's all true. I think you froze, Therese. It's Teresa, right? Okay, Teresa, you froze. I hope you come back. Okay. I think she, oh, you're back.
I'm back.
Okay.
I'm sorry. My computer just froze.
What was the last
froze.
Thing you heard?
You said own something.
Yes. Own. Own those three things about you, that you are super professional, you're a seasoned performer, and you have an exquisite instrument.
You're right.
And if
you're right.
The more you own that,
and
then also I would go to the fancier, I don't know if you do the, like, the venues or the event planners, and just be like, here's the thing. I know, and this is what you say to the event planners, I know you specialize in, you know, very important events that people are paying a lot of money for, and they're often in bigger spaces. And I just know that I have amplification and my instrument is a different type, you know, this type of harp, and it can fill a space, because if people hire a harpist that has a smaller size of harp, they might get it cheaper, but they're not going to be able to hear it.
Yeah.
And I just want you to let you know I exist in case that's something your customer wants. And if you start going out and getting yourself a few other funnel people that just operate on the price level that you would be good in, then I think that you'll be off to the races.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I think what's just hard is, well, it's like tricky.
No, go ahead.
Because am I a little delayed? Do you see me now?
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know if I was delayed.
Yeah.
I think what is difficult is that sometimes, like, a lot of harpists do charge a little bit lower than what we should be getting paid for because of that fear. Like, there used to be, like, so many gigs for harpists, and, like, a lot of harpists I know, like, who are some of my teachers who charge so low, and I'm like, honey, how are you surviving? And you know, that's kind of what gets in the back of my head, but I know it doesn't feel right for me to charge that, especially with everything else that I have going on. And it feels like I'm doing a disservice to myself. And then I know I don't like perform my best because that's what's in my head. So yeah, like it's just been tricky trying to navigate like what a lot of people in my community do often do and what I don't want to do. And I think that just means just owning those things, like you said, right? And just accepting the fact that I don't have to do it the way that everyone else does it, especially if it doesn't feel right.
Yeah. And it is really difficult to separate from the tribe in any way.
Yeah.
But you being an artist already separated you from a tribe. Maybe it's your family tribe, and you being a freelancer separated you from a tribe. So you have those muscles already.
Yeah.
But that's why people say it's lonely at the top, because success does require you separating yourself from tribe after tribe after tribe, because there's fewer people who are willing to build the muscles and the marketing knowledge to get paid more.
Yeah.
And there's more people who take the leap of faith and try to form a business of their own. It just, there's fewer people.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to get used to that, or else you stay in the tribe.
You're so right.
And it's okay to make the choice. I want to stay in the tribe for all these different reasons, whatever. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But you usually can't necessarily have both. The good news is when you do separate from an older tribe, you can also find a newer tribe. Like it's like you floating around alone all the time. Like you find your new group of people.
Yeah. 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 And like another thing that sometimes, I don't know why, because I'm not doing this, but sometimes it feels like if I'm the one who's like out of that tribe, like that's charging more than my community peers, like it's like I'm scamming people, but like I'm not, definitely not, like, you know, I'm the one who will stay up all night like trying to make sure the music sounds amazing for someone's event, but it just feels like I don't want people to think that of me, like I don't want people, like I'm taking advantage because it's your wedding that I'm like trying to charge, you know, more than what is right, basically.
Right. And you, a one way that you can get a lot of energy back in your life is to just not try to manage other people's feelings.
Yeah. Working on that.
You have no control over what they're going to think about you. And by the way, I wouldn't be surprised if you had a client every now and then who went out, tried to find a cheaper harpist, and then was like, oh God, can I hire you, please? You know, they can change their mind, even if they think of you in one way. And their opinion of you isn't actually about you. It's about their scarcity and their money, their history. And they're like, well, I had somebody say to me once, I said, this is my organizing rate. It's this much an hour. And she was like, well, I only make this much an hour. And I was like, well, we could talk about that and I could help you with that. But like,
that's a different session.
But you see how she did not hire. I mean, she just couldn't get past. But it's like, but that was all her stuff.
That's powerful. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
And that is a real managing other people's feelings is a roadblock to your own success.
For sure.
People are gonna think what they're going to think.
Yeah. Yeah. That part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now here's the ninja level. If you really want to challenge yourself, here's the ninja level.
What is this?
What you just said is like, but I'm not scamming anybody. I'm charging this much, but oh my God, I'm making sure it's like great and perfect and then blah, blah. The ninja level is, yes, I'm charging more and I'm not trying to prove my worth around that. You don't actually have to work extra because you raised your rates.
God.
You can work exactly the way you've satisfied all your other clients before. And
yeah.
Just more. And the interesting thing is, as you gain mastery and as you gain marketing muscles and as you gain a reputation, you actually work less because your little operation is running smoothly. You're really good at what you do. You've got your repertoire, you know, and you're working less and making more because you're
in demand.
You know, I mean, when Lady Gaga gets paid $3 million, or any singer gets paid $3 million to go to a private birthday party for some sultan in Dubai,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh my God, they're paying me $3 million for a night. I better work extra hard. They're like,
yeah.
You know, what can I phone in? Yeah. Little mini concert, like, and collect the cash.
For sure.
Do they do a good job? Yes, because they're a seasoned performer and they know the drill, but they don't work extra hard based on what they get paid. You don't get paid when you do the Super Bowl. But that's probably one of the things everybody works the hardest for. So we really have to separate out the amount I'm getting paid and the amount of energy and effort and things. Because past a certain point, you actually, you just know it. You don't need to do that anymore.
Yeah, so
at
true.
That point, you're really good at what you do with this harp.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I challenge you, next time someone pays you, you know, your $3,000, you're like, great. I'm going to enjoy how easy this is for me.
I love that. That, and I feel like energetically, that's important to be in alignment in that way, because I feel like you attract more of like those $3,000 jobs when you're like not saying like, oh, but I'm not, I have to do all this stuff. Yeah, that,
yes.
Yeah, that's, I get it. I get it. It
because
clicks.
You know how wealth is created? Wealth is created through exponential income. You work this and you get paid this. That's wealth. It's not, if you stay, and women are definitely conditioned, because that's how they keep us in our place. If you're conditioned where you earn, it's a tit for tat. I only earn as much effort as I do. And if I want to earn more, I have to work harder. And it's impossible. It keeps you at a ceiling. You have to manage your own weird feelings around like, holy shit, I can't believe I'm getting paid this much money. I mean, I would do this for free.
Yeah.
I got good at that because I loved organizing so much and I totally would have done it for free. But I was like, oh, and I get to take this check too, like it's crazy money because I'm having so much fun. But a lot of people feel if they're having fun, they shouldn't get paid so much. But it's the value. It's not the work you do. It's the value you create. Oprah gets paid so much because she does this much for a lot of people. Her show did this much, but for like millions. So she If actors on Friends were not better actors when they were being paid $1 million an episode, they didn't start acting harder. They were doing the exact same thing as they were. In fact, it was easier. 6 years into the show, it was like clockwork. Easier and they were getting paid more. And the reason they were getting paid more wasn't because of their effort. It was just because the show had a bigger pie and they got a piece of that pie. The pie grew. The whole pie grew. So if you're doing a wedding that's $2 million, $3,000 to the harpist, like, sure. That's a big pie. Those are the pies
you
have to slice them. Yeah. So that's food for thought. I want you working at the ninja level. Now, Therese, this is something I wanted to talk to you about. You wrote, okay, so you're thinking about some revenue models that you can add to your heart business in the new year, particularly thinking about doing private events that include your meditation coaching, like your own thing where you're doing meditation and it's a harp. But you're feeling the first step for this is building a more robust email list
through the podcast that you're starting in January. Okay, so what's the podcast?
The podcast is all things wellness, self-help, things that, you know, people have come to me over the years when I've like run accountability programs and things like that, who have asked me for advice and for help in that way. So I'm still working on like the exact format of it, but I know it's something that I've been working on for a while and that I really want to pursue. And I think it would be a great way to kind of bring in that email list, like I was saying, because I already have an Instagram started. So I was going to like funnel the podcast in through the Instagram and have like, you know, takes from that on there. And then, yeah, just like another way to bring that content in and then hopefully create that list as I finish my Chopra meditation training.
Right. Okay. And do you know how to edit audio?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like annoying. It takes me a long time, but I do know how to do it.
Yeah. It takes a podcast is a lot of work. And were you thinking about filming the podcast and also putting it on YouTube?
I was going to probably film some of it. Yeah.
Do you know how to video edit?
Yes. Okay. I do. Because I do self-tapes. So
here's a thought.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about podcasts, unless you like just super love the medium, audio, I happen to love the medium of audio and I love podcasts, but podcasts don't have any kind of algorithm that helps people find you. All about your own marketing of, hey, I have a podcast and whatever. YouTube is a platform. It's a search engine. So if you're going to do audio only, also at least post them on YouTube, even if it's just audio only. But if you're going to start, it sounds to me like you want to sort of put some information out there so that people discover you and that you can then invite them onto your email list and eventually have, you know, something you sell to them, like a meditation thing or a whatnot, or who's it? Because you can film it, put it on YouTube and extract the audio and make a podcast out of that too. YouTube is that there's a chance for it to be helped through the algorithm chance for people to discover you that does not exist on podcast platforms. There's no like random, hey, check out this podcast. You can buy ads and stuff. But so it's a lot of effort either way, podcast, YouTube thing. And I'm not saying become a YouTuber. I'm just saying you're going to create this like 20-minute episode.
Yeah.
If you can film it and learn just a little bit about keywords, you definitely want your video to be over 8 minutes long, because if it's under 8 minutes, it will never be able to be monetized. So monetization happens for videos longer than 8 minutes, at least right now. And just give yourself the best chance of being discovered by someone searching for stuff.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Because I mean,
no, that makes sense. If you're going to put in that work, you want to make sure it's actually like out there.
I want you to think about that, because if someone was like, I'm going to only do one or the other, I would say do YouTube, because it's a search engine where the pod. Now in Google, yes, you can Google something and a podcast episode can come up. But if you have video and it comes up on Google, like the video's there and it's been studied, people click on video, click on images way more than they do. So just something to think about.
I love it.
And more people consume video than they do audio. Even though podcasts are wildly popular, it's still a smaller fragment of the world listening to podcasts. Then, you know,
Just a
I
thought.
love that.
A thought.
No, it's a great thought, and I appreciate it.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I think you answered it.
All
I
right.
mean, my computer keeps freezing because you're sharing such amazing
That
information. She can't handle it. She's like, no, I can't. Thank you, Christine. I
Yeah, so
really
the smart,
appreciate.
you're very, very welcome. I think you're very talented and I'm happy
Oh,
to help.
thank you.
But you're very, very smart in that, yes, email list, email list, email list,
Hit
always
that
email.
hard.
Yeah. So,
Okay.
you know, and you want to have something that is the reason people go to your email list. Like, hey, I'll give you this thing. Come, you know, and it's in the comments.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'm gonna think
Try it
about
out.
that
And
and explore it.
if you hate doing the YouTube thing, you're like, no, I want to do a podcast. That's fine. You just extract all that audio and
Yes,
slap it up.
there. Yeah, perfect. I love it. Thank
Okay.
you. You're a
Good,
rock
good.
star.
You're welcome. You're well welcome. Ileana.
Hello.
Okay. Hello. Cashflow Kitten. Thinking about what the concept is, but right now we're talking about mindset around driving. We talked about last time you got this new job. Yay. It requires a commute. And you're like, I'm a brand new driver. And you took the advice of like, just ride share that first week so you can
Yeah.
go and do your job without worrying. And I love that you've been mixing it up. Sometimes you're driving, sometimes you're ride sharing, sometimes you're public transportation. Great. But you're having this fear, which boils down to even on the days when I make the drive and nothing goes wrong, I still get a big bodily stress response around this idea that I'm putting my life in danger when I get behind the wheel. There is no one better to talk to about this than me because this is me going out with my dad, to practice driving for getting a license. We go out like in our little tiny neighborhood, there's like no traffic. I'd get behind the wheel and there would be a car coming, one car coming down the street, and I'd pull over to the side. Oh, there's another car. I just gotta let it pass. I failed the written part of my driver's test four times.
Oh.
I wonder what that was about. I think I was just so freaked out about having to take the driving part of the driving test that I failed the written four times. I'm not an idiot. Like there was something going on with my brain. And this was way back in the day, kids, when we had driver's ed classes at our high school. So it's like I was untrained. I was just so scared. So I basically did not get my driver's license till I was 18. And the reason I got it is because I was like going to college in another state. And I'm like, I probably should have an ID, like a driver's license. So I got it. Didn't drive until after I graduated college. My boyfriend, who is now my husband, but we had to drive from we I did right after I graduated, I did summer stock in Idaho. And then once that thing, that was like a month and a half, once that ended, he and I had to drive back from Idaho to Portland, Oregon, which was quite a drive. And it wasn't great for one person to do that all by themselves. So I was like, okay, I'm going to drive. And he was sitting there and he would talk me through it. He'd be like,
Oh.
hey, someone's coming up on your left. They're going to pass you. So I had this person just coaching me through it. Then we get back. We're now in Los Angeles. And even when I was kind of like, okay, I know how to drive, we'd be in the car and then I'd be driving. He'd put his hand on my knee and I'd be like, don't touch me while I'm driving. I need to be completely like focused. Like just, I cannot, don't talk. Don't say any, like I was very sensitive, shall we say? And that was surface streets. So then it was like, oh shit, freeway. Now, luckily, I'm so lucky that I really, 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 really wanted to be a working actor. And my first paying gig as a working, my regular paying gig as a working actor was to go into schools and do these like presentations, like, you know, like, it was about like drugs and say no to drugs. And we'd do these like improv-y things, but we had to get there at like, you know, 6:30 in the morning. And these schools were like far away. That's how I learned the freeway system. Cause I had to get out there sometimes when it was pitch black. And you know what? You know who's on the freeways? At the crack of dawn, giant trucks. And I was like, oh fuck, oh fuck. The whole time was just like, I thought I was going to die. But I wanted this job and I wanted to be an actor and I knew I'd have to drive the freeways. And my mother never drove the freeways. She was so scared. So I came from a thing where my dad drove all the time. And, you know, it was just, yeah. So that's my driving experience. And even today, the mind is a strange thing. And I can be driving along and just get like, you know, you just feel yourself getting a little panicky, or you have a close call and you're just like, whoa. And you have to calm your mind down in the moment. Like you have to, driving is about wrangling your brain. For a group of people, driving is mindless for a lot of group of people. And those are the ones that cause all the accidents. Where driving is a video game for some people. You know, and then everyone's on drugs. So it's fun out there. It's super, super fun. But even on my best days, things go smoothly. But on my second best days, there are usually times when I had to wrangle my mind. And after the pandemic, I was barely driving before the pandemic. And then it's like, I had to get used to those freeways again. It was like, oh, hello. Look at all these cars. I'm going very fast. Yeah. So I'm just saying all of that to say that I totally get it. So let's
talk
about what can help you, because it's good to move yourself through this, not just so that you have the independence and autonomy of driving, but also so that you're building these mind muscles, wrangling your brain. So you want to set. Okay. So first thing, you can definitely Google anxious driving, how to help. There's lots of information out there. And you might look up episode 55 of a podcast called The Anxious Truth.
Oof.
That's all about anxious driving and how to, you know. So setting very small goals for yourself. Like, I'm going to drive twice this week. I'm going to drive four times this week. And I know that you wrote that you are regularly beating yourself up about the price of rideshare. I want you to think about it like you're taking a class in driving.
Oh, if you're
going to pay for taking a class in driving, that, you know, the rideshare is just the cost of you getting acclimated to driving. It's kindness to yourself. On days when you maybe have a big meeting or you just don't want to be stressed, it's okay to do the ride share. Also, you might practice on your days off with a very calm person like my husband. My husband also taught my sister how to drive freeways. He's just super calm and he just tells you what's going on, like, you know, okay, we're gonna merge to the left, okay, you know, it's clear, you can do that, check your mirrors, like you just want somebody like that. Super chill. So maybe doing some practice for like just changing lanes on the freeway during rush hour, that kind of stuff. Then it really is about getting yourself to breathe and relaxing your hands on the wheel. You know, sometimes when I'm driving, I'm like, oh my God, I'm like gripping this wheel within an, it's like, relax. And I'm not, every time I get behind the wheel, I'm not like, oh, here we go. But there's just times, you know, where I find myself gripping the wheel. So you want to talk to yourself with a lot of kindness. I'm doing this great. Things are going smooth. I've got this. I'm going to be able to handle it. And then calming music
Or maybe there's even some sort of audio thing that people have created that you could play while you're driving, like, hey, you've got this. Like something like that. And then there's also hypnosis. You might try that. And then the other thing is we have to be really realistic. There's only one thing you can kind of control, which is your own driving environment inside your car and the maintenance of your car. But it's like, have what you need. If you need like some water, take the lid off so it's there and you know, don't have to futz with that. Get everything set up, check all, you know, get yourself prepared in your car. Leave a little extra time so you can have what you need in your car and have it arranged in the way that you need it. And then, of course, you can't control, but you can mitigate some other exterior factors. Like maybe if it's pouring rain, you take the ride share, you know?
Yeah.
So, and the times of maybe you go extra early. So time is not putting any pressure on your driving. Maybe you do surface streets instead of the freeway or, you know, whatever. So maybe when you're on your period, you don't, you know, you take a ride share or public transport. Like you just decide as you're getting acclimated. It's not that you're learning how to drive. It's you're getting acclimated to driving. And driving in Los Angeles, it's like you're taking driving 401 instead of 101. Like yeah. It's a whole different thing to get acclimated to driving in LA. And people who are really great at driving in LA, it would be a whole other story for them to drive in New York. It's just a complete, you're not even driving fast. Like you're just inching along, but you have to kind of be aggressive in a way that you don't necessarily have to be out here. Like, yeah. So you're getting acclimated to driving in LA. Here's the thing. Driving's dangerous.
Yeah.
Driving's dangerous. Like we have to be really real about that. Saying that it's not, no, it's fine. Your mind's going to call bullshit on that anyway. So it's, you might as well just admit that, yeah, it's a really dangerous thing to do, especially when most other people are on drugs out there, you know, when I used to have a joke, I'm just like, everyone's on drugs. It's like, okay, that's not helping. I'm like, well, it's dangerous and shit can happen. It is 100% true. And I'm always saying to myself, well, this is how I want to have an accident. I want to have an accident. While I'm saying, I've got this, it's okay. Then an accident versus, oh shit. That's not how I want to go through an accident. So, but also, you will get hit. Your beautiful, pristine car is probably going to get a dent. It's just, yeah, it's real hard to keep your car in tip-top shape, you know, like appearance-wise. So you don't want to be super connected in that way to your vehicle and like safety first. But you'll probably get in a tiny scrape to a little accident to an either more accident. It's uncontrollable because there's too many. All you can do is tell the universe, hey, or any of your sisters who are up there looking out for you, hey, help me, you know, help me get through this as best as I can. And that's it. And then the chips have to fall where they may, because life is dangerous. Life is a contact sport. But you're doing it. And that's all that you can ask of yourself. And the worst thing you can tell yourself is, I should be able to do this by now. This shouldn't be such a big problem. Why shouldn't I just get over it? I'm an adult. It's like, no. No. Certain things are harder for certain people and certain things are easier for other people. Like, who knows? Who cares? So how does all of that sound?
Oh, and incredibly helpful. Thank you so much. It's, yeah. I think there has been a lot of like,
it's been like people do this at 16 and you can't do this, but like I know that that's ridiculous, and the it's really helpful to have the reminder that like the part of me that feels in danger every time I get in a car is not wrong, it's just not helpful.
Yeah.
And then I can like focus on the helpful parts. The calming music thing has been helpful. So I did do some of the research. One thing that threw me earlier in this week is that I did do some of the research of like new driver, what can make you feel like better? Or actually my mother sent me a link, and then I opened the link and every single thing that it said not to do, I was doing. It was like don't jump. It was like, don't jump into taking freeways, start with very small local trips. I was doing the freeway commute like a week after getting the car. I had no local trips. It was a lot of like, it was basically just advocating for easing into it in a way that I totally didn't do. And in a way it was like, oh, that explains why I feel so horrible. And like, it is definitely better now than it was before, which is great. But I am still like the way that the fear manifests is that I get all warm. So the first couple of times I drove myself home from work, I was like, I have to take my temperature. Surely I have a fever. It's a trillion degrees what's happening. And it was not a fever, it was emotions. So I think like I've been turning on the air in the car, and I'll sort of see what I can do to help make that better. But I think like I will start talking out loud to myself and saying, good job, good merging.
Yeah.
Look at that. We're in the lane now. No more lane changes. Now I'm in the lane.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Just talk to yourself every step of the way. Mm-hmm. And no pressure, no blaming. And by the way, one of the things, like when I drive on Coldwater and Laurel Canyon and Sepulveda, where people drive all the time there, so they know all the twists and turns, but they're not driving defensively because they're assuming nothing's going to be around the next turn.
Mm-hmm.
And they hate getting behind me because like, oh, honey, we are going to the speed limit.
Yes!
So relax. I'm leading the train, the conga line, I call it. I am leading the conga line, and you're getting a chance to learn how to manage your mind around someone who's not going fast right now. And sometimes, you know, but you have to be willing to hold your own space and just be like, I need this, you know, and other people can wait for me because that's good practice for them. I'm not driving at 15 miles per hour because that people would, you know, shoot me, but like I'm going speed limit, but I'm not zipping around, you know, just because my mother-in-law, when she drives, she feels the pressure of the car behind her. And I'm like, you have to not worry. You have to not worry about them.
Mm-hmm.
Let them deal with it. You know?
That's great. That's really helpful.
Yeah. You really jumped into it. So maybe surface street. And another thing to do, because each time you have a new place to go, I'm taking regular weekly lessons with someone who's in Santa Monica. And I decided, okay, this is the best way to get to her house. And it was kind of a new freeway route. And it took me like four times before I was like, right, okay, this is when I need to merge so that I can go on that off ramp. And it was just like, you know? And it's also another trick is I like to look at a map before I go so I can visually understand my route. And then I write down the directions of like 101 to the 5, whatever, south. Like, and then, because I don't listen to GPS. I don't want to hear about adjustments. I don't want to hear about, I don't need someone chattering at me in two more miles. I'm like, I'll see the off-ramp when I need to. I don't need you to. Now, some people love it. I don't. So this is about you creating the environment that works for you, not what should be or what works for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Create the environment that works for you. And then test things out as you get more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a new route that you want to try, you know, going early on a Sunday morning, you can try the route out with very few cars on the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whew, that's, I really appreciate the like figuring out what works best for me. There was like one day where playing calming music helped a lot. And then for some reason, the very next day I had music on and I was like, this is the most distracting thing in the world. How could I possibly, how did this work yesterday?
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, like the trial and error process That's really helpful. And remembering that I'm not going to get it all right away.
Yep. I only like to drive with music or something on the audio. If I don't have any audio on, I find that my thoughts, I'm tuning into my thoughts much more. And I'm like, nope, need the distraction. Yeah. Need the distraction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, the other thing is that I have a friend who just, she's all about like, what's the fastest way? So she has her GPS and she just likes, you know, changing lanes all the time. Like just wants to get ahead, which is great for her. She loves it. She's a very good driver. Like I pick my route. I don't give a shit if that's the longest route. It's like, this is the route that feels most comfortable for me. I've driven it 400 times. Mm-hmm. These are the freeways I love. This is how we're doing it. Like I am the most uncreative driver when it comes to like routes. I don't care. Well, I know how to get there one way and that's the way. And then, you know, if there's an accident, I'll pull off, look at a map and pick another route. But because it just makes me not have to think about things while I'm driving.
Mm-hmm.
I've picked my route. I've looked at the map. We're going to go. And then I can say much calmer when I drive. So, you know, don't be ashamed of being an old lady like me. <That's> really I'm driving like an old lady at 27.
Yeah, that honestly sounds amazing. Thank you. Thank you so much. That helps a lot.
Good, good, good. And this is all part of, it's definitely part of cash flow because this affects how you walk in the door to your job.
Yeah.
And how much energy and bandwidth and mind space you have to give to your job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
extended it all just getting there.
I noticed that in a weird, like there was a meltdown day where it was like the first day I was taking the bus in and it didn't come. It just didn't come. And so then I had to go to like walk to another bus and then the other bus also didn't come. And then I could wait for another bus, but yeah. There was like, if I wait for that bus, then I'll be late. So I had to call a car. But the reason that I had taken the bus in the morning is that I was going to an event after work that like was going to require rideshare. So basically it ended up being like $100 day of rideshare because of all of that. And I literally spent the whole day trying not to cry. I was like, I can't believe that nobody's asking me about how clearly upset I am. Obviously no one knew anything, but like that had such a profound effect on how my day went. And I was kicking myself for not driving the whole day, which also wasn't helping.
Yeah. Six of one, half dozen of the other. Who knows? Who knows why you weren't meant to be on the road that day? Maybe you actually avoided something. That's what I always tell myself when I miss an off-ramp or when I'm delayed at traffic. It's like, oh, the universe is making sure I'm not involved in whatever that was or whatever may have been off that. Little stories. But I have been there when the bus has just either it was too full or it never came. Oh yeah. I've walked home to my home in Glendale from Burbank because the last bus and it was like, oh fuck. And I didn't have anybody to call like with a car. And think of all the people who have to literally rely on public transport here. I mean, it's crazy. They can't just call a car.
Yeah.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
That was what I tried to do. Like, I made myself write a gratitude list for like grateful that I had the money to get the car, even though I'm frustrated. Like grateful that the bus was so early that I still made it to work on time, even though everything happened.
Right?
Even though I was gritting my teeth through that, it did kind of help. Yeah, you're right.
Yep, that's the best thing to do when something goes awry. Is like, okay, but what are the things I'm still grateful for?
Mm-hmm.
Force yourself to really like 20 things. 30 things, like, because you can really make that list. Yeah, the fact that you were able, you had the privilege to have the stuff to get you to work on time and the timing worked out so that you weren't late. Like, yeah, that's all really great, great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you have AAA?
I do.
Okay. There you go. That's great. It's great. Yeah, sounds like you're taking all the precautions and doing all the things.
Thanks. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And, you know, driving is like a big metaphor. It's just for life. Life is so risky and we don't
know what's coming. And it's just, there's so many variables beyond our control. All we can do is try to bring our best self in the moment to the moment. You know, like I wrote this in my journal years ago. I don't know what the next moment brings, but I know what I can bring to the next moment.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, guys, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Thank you for hanging out, doing cash flow. And yeah, we will reconvene for our last two sessions of the year in December. Good to see you.
Hi. Grateful for you, Christine. Hi. So great to hear everyone.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kate.
Bye, everybody.
Good luck, Eliana. Take care, Christine.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, bye, guys.